Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. We welcome you, whatever time and wherever in the world you are listening. We are pleased you have found us. You are now listening to Inside the Bunghole, a podcast taking you on a journey through wine. Together, we will learn more about this wonderful elixir of life. So raise your glass to welcome your hosts and partners in wine, Pam and James. You are now Inside the Bunghole.
Hello and welcome to Inside the Bunghole. I am here with the lovely Pam Hudgens and I'm James Salisbury.
Hello everybody, and again our producer Don Maselli's with us.
Don, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. Good afternoon.
I'm excited about our guest. You brought someone wonderful with us. In fact, we're here in her shop. So
yes, we are. Desert 111 Wine Shop, and I'm sure that our wonderful guest today, Katie Finn, a phenomenal human being and a very intelligent and a beautiful woman, is here to talk to us about some great wines, about her experience as a first-class sommelier, as well as about some of her likes, dislikes, and I think we're going to be doing a Riesling tasting. Is that right?
That is right, and my golly, with those kind of compliments, you want me on every week? Is this the kind of intro I can expect every time I'm on? That's sensational. Yes, we are going to taste three Rieslings from three different regions. And what I hope is we're going to kind of debunk some myths about Riesling, too, while we're at it.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful.
Before we start getting into the wine, let's get into the wine lady.
Hurry.
We're thirsty. Well,
yes, I know. We're thirsty.
First of all, we're so blessed to have you here in our community.
Oh, thank you.
To have a neat wine shop. I mean, how lucky we are.
It's awesome that, and you know, the support from the community is what makes this possible, and the fact that we can bring in wines that are a little more obscure, a little more off the beaten path, and get the support from wine adventurers to try things makes this possible. Otherwise, you know, we would carry all the same grocery store stuff everybody else does, but you know, we have a wonderful group of people who support us and want to taste the kind of fun, weird wines that we, you know, bring to the table. And I say weird in a good way, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Weird in an exciting way.
Well, how do you buy for the wine shop? What is your mindset? What do you...
Yeah, so, you know, our biggest thing is we have a really small footprint. And so every wine that comes in that sits on the shelf has to have a purpose. We don't have a huge warehouse where we can just stock it and be all things to all people. There has to be rhyme and reason to it. And most of the time, the number one thing is, okay, look, is this in BevMo? Is this in Total? Because I can't compete. I don't want to compete. They can have the cases and, you know, the production that they're making 5 million cases of this. That's not what we're about. And then the second thing is it interesting? Does it have a story? Is it delicious? And is there quality to value? Meaning, if I open this wine and I take a sip and I love it, and then you tell me it's $15, my head's going to explode because now it's even that much better.
Right.
Those are the fun finds. And, you know, I'm always saying anybody can spend $100 on a bottle of wine and it better be damn good.
Yeah.
It's when you spend $30 on a bottle of wine and it tastes like it's twice that, that you've found a real winner. And that's a testament too to the winemaker that with limited resources or without just throwing money at something, they were able to create an awesome product at a value. And those are good, the kind of things. And, you know, I want to carry Rabola Jala and educate people on what the heck that is.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fun, weird things that maybe, you know, for a long time, this valley never saw. You know, all the wine shops carried the same thing over and over. And so we have this opportunity to introduce people to their favorite wine that they didn't even know existed.
Right. I was here earlier and before we strapped our mics on, but you were with a client and you were saying, oh, this is great. Even with the frozen pizza, it's a nice little sexy little wine. The way you were describing it, it's juicy. And I think you sold them on it, but it was great, you know?
Well, and sometimes, you know, if people, they want to embrace wine, but it's a commitment. You're spending money on something and it's not, you know, it's not like a beer. It's not like, you know, something else where, oh, well, if it wasn't your cup of tea, no big deal. I mean, you're dropping $30-$40 on something. You want to have the security that you might like it. You know, there's no guarantee, but you at least want to kind of go into it with some knowledge of what you're going to expect, right?
And you are a sommelier.
Yes.
I want to go a little bit into that and how that helps you guide somebody to the right wine. But first, tell me a little bit about your background.
Okay, so I got into this whole crazy wine thing when I was in university, and I needed to get a job where I could make a lot of money as a college kid, right? Mm-hmm. And so I immediately was like, I'll go work at a steakhouse, right? I had a girlfriend, and she was making like hundreds of dollars a night, and I was like, this is insane. How does this happen? So I applied for a job, and at the time, I think I knew there was a difference between white and red. Maybe that's even a stretch, but I knew there were differences in wines. And they said, well, maybe cocktail waitress, maybe server here is a little ambitious for someone of your stature. Mm-hmm. And I promised I would study the wine list backwards and forwards and get to know it. And this was a restaurant that kind of, the first of its kind, had 100 wines by the glass. Wow. And so,
and this was in,
Orange County.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, and I guess it's no secret, it was Fleming's, and Fleming's Steakhouse, you know, they had this very progressive wine program. And I just said, okay, I'm going to dive into it. I'm going to learn about it. Well, I was a poli-sci major in university. And as I was studying about the wines, what I was recognizing was there were so many similarities between what I was studying politically and geography and history with these regions and what was happening with these wine countries and what was happening in the wine world when I was studying vintages and things. And it was,
were your folks drinking wine?
Oh my God, I'm Irish. Nobody in my house drank wine.
So this is all
whiskey and beer.
Just for a J-O-B, you studied it.
I did.
And okay, wow.
I did.
Awesome.
Well, and that leads me to the funny thing. So I ended up falling in love, and it was became my passion, obviously. And I had this this opportunity that presented itself. Fleming's offered to put me or to send me to the Court of Masters to take my exam, and I gladly took it, and I passed. And that was back when there were three levels, right? Now there's more, but that was back when, you know, there was just three. And so I passed my first level, and I was at that point a certified sommelier. Like, I was pinned. I had the full deal, and I was hooked because I got to taste wine and eat food for a living. Like, I could not imagine. And so I had decided that I wasn't going to continue on with university at the time.
Wow.
And I told my dad, this was, I was going to become a sommelier, and this was going to be what I did. Not very happy with me.
No.
I can say that was, yeah. He was not a glorified waiter, I think is what I had become in his mind, and he was not thrilled. And when he was trying to explain to my very Irish grandfather that I was no longer a political science major in university, that I was now a sommelier, and my grandfather in his Irish brogue, a sommel, what? What the hell is that, a sommelier? Yeah. What is it? And he couldn't wrap his head around it, didn't understand. Finally, after my dad kind of broke it down in the simplest terms, my grandfather says, wait, Lord be Jesus, you mean she's getting paid to drink? I was the favorite. At that point, I'm now the golden child. I had it figured out.
Brilliant.
I was the yes. cream of the crop. And then from there, I actually did go on and finish college, which later down the road, but the sommelier career just took off, and I was offered a position to be the director of wine for Roy's in Hawaii, and I did that. And I became a sommelier for Roy's in Newport Beach, moved here to the Valley, and started working for a distribution company called Epic Wines, which was a wonderful endeavor. Was doing private wine events and wine education for local restaurants, and then Epic moved me to Napa. And, you know, so I mean, my career just kept spiraling, and I think even if I wanted to do something different, I couldn't. Like, yeah. I was just on this trajectory where wine just is my life, and that's where I am today now.
So, Katie, other than a lot of studying, there's a couple of things that a sommelier has to sacrifice. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So, I smoked for years because
right.
part of, you know, in being in the industry.
Yeah, yes, waiting tables, the whole thing.
I mean, it's waiting tables and working in restaurants. It's not a job, it's a lifestyle. And you work when everybody else plays, and you sleep when everybody else works. And I mean, there's a whole thing that goes along with it. But what I recognized is, at the end of the day, I had a palate where I could identify things, and it did come a little easier for me. Mm-hmm. But the sacrificing comes in the form of time and money. Listen, studying for wine means you've got to buy a lot of wine. And wine is not cheap.
No,
and especially when you're trying to tell the difference between, you know, Burgundy Grand Crus and Premier Crus and Bordeaux First Gross. I mean, stop it. Like, that's why there's study groups where everybody brings a bottle, so we're at least dividing the cost and trying to be a little more manageable on the finance aspect of it. But, you know, it requires just an inordinate amount of studying. And it's all-encompassing. You know, I think there's... it goes just beyond being able to, what I call like the dumb party game, doing a blind tasting. I mean, nobody ever uses that. Right. I mean, oh, so I can identify this wine blind. Yippee
we
for
do,
me.
We do it.
Well, it's funny you say that because I
and
called
I
you up.
At it.
I called you up one afternoon and I said, we want to do a blind wine tasting
with
the three
go.
Of us.
Yeah.
And we just decided on a theme, and the theme again was...
told her to pick the theme, and
exactly.
she picked MS...
GSM.
GSM.
Right?
From around the world, yeah.
And we had a really good time with it.
And
it was
if
a
no
lot
one
of
knows
fun.
What GSM is...
Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre.
Yeah,
those blends
together.
And we had the time of our lives with it, because, you know, we were just playing around with the different grapes, and... You had said
three
Grenache, and I think you had said Syrah. I'm like, we're almost there. And but knowing that it was a blend, and you know, oftentimes a really great blend is a GSM.
Right.
It really opened up our palates and our eyes, and we thank you for that experience. And it was a time of our lives. And
well, another thing that's really helped us do silly, goofy things like that is coming to wine tastings, like the one you have. You have a great wine tasting, and it's a small shop, but a great group of people come.
Yeah.
And you educate.
Thank you. Yeah, our wine community is dynamic. I mean, the group of people that come here. And, you know, the thing that we've noticed time and time again is people walk in here as strangers and they leave as friends. Mm-hmm. And we have seen friendships created from meeting here in the shop at the tastings. There is no greater feeling in the world that we somehow helped foster that in the community. And these are people that are like-minded or maybe not, but I mean, they're here because they like wine. And, you know, listen, you get a couple glasses in you and you get a little loosey-goosey and all of a sudden, you know, it's easier to make friends in that environment. And
even if you have differing opinions,
it
seems you have a common bond.
There's a common denominator. And this common denominator that I love is it's not offensive in any way, right? There's no triggering points to any of this. You can talk about wine, and I feel like wine's a safe space, right? One's going to be upset about whatever your opinion is about this.
Exactly.
And it might be the only thing left in the world where you can have an opinion and not lose a friend over it.
Now, Katie, how do we, you do the wine tastings when? I know before COVID we would do them in the shop on Tuesdays and Fridays. Mm-hmm. Is that still the case?
So we've gone down to just doing the Fridays virtually on Zoom. And, you know, listen, at first it was like, oh, Zoom, oh my gosh. Okay, so let's make the best of this situation and let's just try to run with it. It turned out, you guys, it's an awesome way to deliver this information, at least for me. What I do miss is the social hour of the Friday tastings where it was very laid back and you just came up and you got a little wine and, you know, maybe there wasn't the educational part of it, but it was just easy and fun.
It was.
Camaraderie.
Someone
camaraderie.
Might show you their boil on their neck. I mean, it was community.
I mean, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. Just, you know, I got the, now where are they? Listen, we're going to take a little break and we're going to come back and we're going to do Rieslings. Is that exciting?
That's awesome.
Okay.
Can't wait.
All right, we'll be right back.
I have cotton mouth.
Oh, good. We'll be right back. You're tuned in to Inside the Bunghole.
If you want to know more about Inside the Bunghole, join us on all our social media platforms. You can get a revisit and view all the latest posts, giveaways, and information on this podcast. Simply search Inside the Bunghole on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Like, share, and subscribe. Leave a comment. We would love to hear from you. Or you can email us at insidethebunghole@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and visit our website at insidethebunghole.buzzsprout.com, where you can always find our latest podcast and past episodes. Cheers!
Welcome back. We're still here and we're going to be tasting some beautiful Rieslings.
We are doing three different Rieslings from three different regions, all super unique, but they do have some commonality to them. The first wine we're tasting is called, the winery is Reeve Wines. This is their Prism Riesling 2019, and this comes from Mendocino.
California.
So this is our California Riesling. And I think when you taste it, there's this natural inclination to assume all Rieslings are sweet, and it couldn't be further from the truth. Riesling, by nature, is acidic and tart and crisp and fresh, and a lot of times the sweetness is needed to kind of counterbalance that acid. Otherwise, it would just 36 grit, it would just rip the palate right off you. I mean, your taste buds would, you know, go down the hatch with the wine. Because, it can be that abrasive in its acid. But that's also what makes them such long-lived wines. That's why you can see Rieslings that are, you know, 50, 60 years old that are still as beautiful as the day they were crafted. And, you know, it all comes down to, one, the quality of the producer, but it's just that beautiful pH and acid level in the wines that make them ready for the long haul. And so Mendocino, relatively cool climate, and where this particular wine comes from has a big influence from Clear Lake. So there is this thing called the lake effect, and this is going to be a consistent theme throughout the wines that we taste, where the water kind of traps in the heat when it needs to and releases the cool air when it needs to. And so it almost acts as if like a natural thermostat for the vineyards that surround it. And so the grapes don't get too cold and the grapes don't get too hot. It really acts as a temperature control for areas that tend to be a little more on the extreme side. But Riesling needs cold because that's, again, what keeps that acid level nice and high. You don't want these grapes getting super duper ripe. These aren't grapes that are well suited for hot climates because, you know, they'll spike and then you'll end up with kind of that mushy baby food.
Like an ice wine or something.
Yeah.
Direction?
The opposite.
Yeah.
Opposite. I would say the opposite of ice wine.
Yeah. And so, you know, and I mean,
mushy.
Ice wine.
Mushy.
Ice wine, and just like, you know, with other sweet Rieslings, the truth behind Riesling is the sweeter it is, the more expensive it is. Because those grapes go through botrytis, right? So they kind of shrivel up, they lose some of their water weight, they get that mold on them, which sounds disgusting, but truly it is delicious.
It sounds like a disease.
It does. It is a disease. It is. But it's a delicious disease, and it produces the sweet nectar of the gods.
It smells wonderful. I do. I smell peach in a way,
yeah.
And I smell, in a weird, a very faint, like, I want to say, not diesel, but
yes.
Earthy.
Yeah, kinda, there's like a petrol.
Petrol, thank you.
And you know, that is, when we play the party game of, you know, name that wine in two sips, the petrol element is what usually is what gives a Riesling away. So I feel like in poker, most wines have a tell, and with Riesling, petrol is its tell. And if you can pick it up even in the faintest quantity.
There's Riesling.
It's
involved.
Yeah, you've got
really?
you've probably got Riesling.
See,
on
there you go.
Was Blue Nun a Riesling?
Yes, it was.
That was a party wine back
yes.
in my
oh
day.
My
now,
God,
is that where they got the reputation for it just being a secondly sweet?
Oversweet wine?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because listen, again.
Who hasn't drank in a bottle of Blue Nun?
Do they still make it? I'm sure it's out there.
I'm sure they have to. You know, I mean, I think I saw Bartles and James the other day, so
nothing ever goes away. Hey, MD2020 is still around.
I'm looking for Boone's Farm. I got my eye out.
Yep. There you go.
I mean, not to total non sequitur, but they brought Zima back for a hot second, and I got really happy about that. And then it went away again, and I was like, but that was high school.
Yeah, it was.
You took my high school memories away from me again. How dare you?
That was the beer I gave my dates.
I mean, Zima. Oh, okay, anyway, I did.
So this beautiful bottle is, what's this retail at the shop?
$19.95, I
That's
think.
That's a great deal.
It's really not a big sugary like I thought.
No,
honest
not
to
at all.
No, and
wow.
that's the thing that I think as we go forward that's going to be the surprising element to these Rieslings is, one, their dryness level, two, just how refreshing and quenching they are, because I think there's also
that's
this notion.
Good, yeah, that's like a good summer wine.
Kind of a little lemon there.
I'm
totally
thinking like avocado toast, Thai food with
Ooh,
this.
Lemony
maybe
avocado
a little
toast.
Bit of shrimp
yeah.
to go along with this.
Well,
a big bag of remorse.
That's the big bag of remorse.
Exactly, that too. How'd you know? You're reading my
Just
mind.
Just curious.
So the secret to perfect food pairings with Riesling, anything spicy, anything salty, which is why foods like Thai food, Japanese food, and Chinese food are such a natural foil for Riesling, because low alcohol level and high acid. So here's the secret to the success behind that. And this is my Roy's time talking, right?
Okay. Meaning pairing this with food?
Pairing this with food.
Okay.
Is alcohol in a wine will increase the food's increase your mouth's perception of a food's salt level and spice level. So if you were to have wasabi and soy sauce, salty and spicy, with a 14% Cabernet. Like, I cringe for what's happening in your mouth at this point. Like, you are in H-E double hockey sticks land, because now all of that alcohol in the wine has increased the heat from the wasabi, the salt from the soy, and it's a mess.
Not the wine, the higher the alcohol.
It's the alcohol. I mean, not to mention red wine is not a good pair for either of those.
Right.
But that's like, I don't know why. Pam likes to put accent on her chicken.
Oh, I put, yeah.
It's like MSG. But anyway, it really hypes it up. But interesting, higher alcohol level, intensify.
Right, and so when you've got Riesling, where you've got the high acid, which kind of acts as like a fire extinguisher for a lot of the heat and salt, and the low alcohol, which kind of tempers it, that's why in Japanese restaurants, you'll see that most Japanese restaurants worth their weight will have a page of Rieslings as an offering, or Gewürztraminers, or kind of any of these colder climate wines, because they just are such a perfect pairing. Like, you can't go wrong. And now, if you like sweeter, great.
Right.
Chances are, the sweeter the
wine.
Plum wine.
So how's it like Mexican food?
Oh, it's great. It's great. Same thing. Great. Spicy, salty. Anything spicy, salty, this is your happy wine.
So, Kate, let's talk about the seven different types. Is it seven different types of Rieslings?
You're
going to
make me think. Okay, Cabernet, Spätlese, Auschlese, Pernauschlese, Trockenbär. Six.
Six.
Unless they've added one that I don't know about.
Uh-oh. Fact check.
Well, that was
this
a good
podcast
one.
Is very, not going to be about lies. We are real media, folks.
Yes. This is not fake wine tasting.
Tell me, like, where are Riesling, the grapes, grown majority-wise in the region and in the world and in the country and in the...
Again, so colder climates tend to be Riesling-dominated. So you have Riesling grown... Obviously in Germany, in Austria, in Alsace, France, in Canada.
I'm going to take a picture of this next one, and we'll talk about it.
In Canada, like the Niagara area, so Eastern Canada.
Wow. Okay.
Like the next wine we're tasting, which is from New York.
Yes.
The Finger Lakes,
upstate,
which is becoming very hot. We talked a little bit about Virginia. And then, of course, the colder regions like, you know, some areas in Walla Walla, Washington, you know, anywhere where
cold
there's
places.
Cold places. Riesling likes, it does well in the cold. And it's, you know, you wouldn't think of it as being a very hardy grape, but it really does well in these areas.
Now, you mentioned that the Mendocino one had a lake effect thing going on. This one's from the Finger Lakes.
So, again, it's
got the foggy.
So Seneca Lake. This comes from the eastern portion of Seneca Lake. This is the Forge Riesling, and this is created by one of my all-time favorite winemakers. His name is Louis Barol. He's a Frenchman. He's known as the Young Turk of Gigondas.
Ooh, that's fancy.
He has a winery, a very famous estate in the Gigondas, France, which is in the southern Côte d'Aronne, called Château Saint-Côme. And this was his first foray into making wine in the United States. And he partnered with two other gentlemen to do this, but he really is kind of the head honcho of the show. And I think quite often you have winemakers that venture off into projects like this because they want to make what they want to drink, right? And so oftentimes if they're not growing Riesling in the Southern Rhone. So if he wants to drink his own Riesling, he's got to go to where they're growing Riesling. And the Finger Lakes is a wonderful area to do it. Again, the lake effect, you've got that. So the Finger Lakes are actually what they sound like. They're like lakes that look like my gangly fingers, you know, spread out like a spider monkey. But, you know, in between all of these lakes, you have the absorption of heat. You have the cooling area of the air around. And so it creates a more temperate
Totally wild.
Climate.
Same grape.
Totally different taste. So Louis wanted to make a Riesling so dry that it almost like hits you up the back of the neck a little bit. You know, like when you're talking of wasabi, you know, when you eat a little too much wasabi and you get that like zoop right up the back of your head. That's kind of what this is. So there is, I think it's 0.3. Let me just double check. 0.3 grams per liter residual sugar in this. To put that in perspective, there is more sugar, residual sugar, in a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc than in this Riesling.
Wow.
That's how dry this Riesling is.
I'm tasting a little bit of jasmine in here. Is that correct?
There is so much floral. There's that star jasmine. I get a little honeysuckle and even, you know, like tiger lilies. You know when you smell tiger lilies? So there's a floral component, but it's not sweet by any means. There's some of that beautiful kind of Asian pear component.
Quince, Asian pear, and chalk.
She cheated. That's the back of the label.
It's on the back of the label. That's a great try.
I love this label.
But I'm tasting
it. Can every wine come with this label, label?
No, that's a cheat sheet. No.
And I took a picture of it and we'll be posting it. Soils, yes, and the residual sugar.
I'm getting a little bit of the Doobie Brothers bus, their tour bus.
Oh, okay. Is there a little...
Yeah, there is.
Which tour are we referring?
Year?
Because they change every year.
Like 76 Doobie Brothers? No, wonderful wine. Really, really awesome. Can you mix Rieslings at all with the grape with anyone? Does it just stand on its own?
Oh, yeah, no. So there is a wonderful wine that is called an Edelsvicker. And Edelsvicker comes from Alsace. And in Alsace, you have very, very strict rules saying that, you know, you grow Gewürztraminer, you grow Pinot Gris, you grow Riesling, but you can't blend or mix them. Like, they have to be single varietal wines that are dedicated to whatever crew. So you had a lot of these Alsatian winemakers that would have grapes, and they wanted something fun that they could drink. And so they started creating what they call an Edelsvicker, which is a blend of those grapes that they would kind of throw in the mix.
Breaking the law.
And it was meant to be just fresh and light and dry and fun and crisp in summer afternoon. Now I'm going to get super nerdy. Yeah. And then there's also a wine called a Gemüchtersalz. Gemüchtersalz.
Even knowing those words is impressive.
Is that where that schooling taught you?
Yes, this is the schooling. So Gemüchtersalz is kind of like an Edelsvicker in Germany, but a Gemüchtersalz is where you've got a bunch of grapes, like a field blend almost, and you have a bunch of different white grapes, and they all get harvested at the same time, and they all get co-fermented. And you don't see them very often because they are pretty rare. But again, it's this very fun, almost modern nouveau take on what they've been doing since antiquity in these regions.
So they're not segregated or anything. They're all thrown in one big...
They're thrown in together. So they're harvested together, which is unusual as well because a lot of times, you know, you've got different ripening levels for different grapes. They'll kind of all come into their physiological ripeness at different times.
Wow. And then the whole village comes and stamps them.
They do.
With their dirty feet.
Foot trod. No, they take their socks off.
Okay, socks off. That's good.
And so, and how do you get these? You come to nerdy little shops like this, and you ask the wine nerds, "Hey, do you have a Gemüchtersalz?" And we say, "By golly,
what if they say, do you have that thing that I've never heard of and can't pronounce?" Will you know what they're talking about?
9 times out of 10, we do. You would be surprised.
If someone was
white or red.
If someone was listening to our podcast, would you say this is the next step or a walk in the park from your Chardonnay drinkers or maybe your Sauvignon Blancs?
Oh.
Like, you guys go out and try a Riesling.
Yeah. Ooh.
Everybody.
Well, I'm just saying, if you're a Sauvignon Blanc person or you're
I think this is definitely more for the people who fall into the other whites category. So I would say probably not the Chardonnay drinker. What I've noticed is that Chardonnay drinkers tend to be very loyal to not only their grape, but the specific Chardonnay that is their happy place.
Right.
So, you know, I'm never going to get somebody who drinks Rombauer Chardonnay to, like, probably go anywhere else because that's their comfort blanket. That's their binky.
Yeah.
But somebody who... You know, hey, I've had a Chenin Blanc and it was pretty good. No, I tried this, you know.
Viognier,
exactly.
Right.
Those are the kind of people that I would say, you know what? Think about Riesling not in the way that you normally think of it as being cloying and dessert winey. Think of it as maybe just an offshoot of that Chenin Blanc or Viognier that you said you really liked. And people are always pleasantly surprised. I did this in a blind tasting once, and I have to tell you, no one guessed it was Riesling for starters. I had people think Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc. I had someone think it was, I can't even remember some of the other, but nobody, Pinot Blanc.
Nobody nailed it.
Nobody thought Riesling. Nobody. Riesling.
There's a slight hint of petrol on here.
It's,
which
it's subtle, but it's there.
I just had to pour myself another glass just to retaste to see if that was it. I hate when that happens.
Can you explain to the listeners the shape of the bottle? It's so Riesling shaped, but why and how did that... Why?
So there are all kinds of different bottle shapes. You know, there's the Bordeaux, which is where you find your Cabernets that are kind of the high-shouldered. There's the Burgundy bottles where you find your Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs. And really where these all came to play was this was the type of bottle and glass available, you know, from whenever this began, for the people to put their wine in. And then it became an iconic symbol of what was in the bottle. So you have all kinds of rule breakers now, where I've seen Pinot Noir in Bordeaux bottles. I've seen, you know, Cabernets in Burgundy bottles. I mean, I've seen all kinds of weird things. So there's really nothing hard and fast. But for Riesling, kind of this tall, slender bottle became its calling card, its benchmark, just like all the other bottle shapes that go into it. So I could be wrong. You can fact check to me, but I'm willing to say that most of the time when it came to the shape of the bottle that's present in the region, it was because that was the shape of the bottle that was available in the region.
Okay.
See, that's a whole history.
I mean,
down that rabbit hole.
Totally.
Well, listen, we're going to... Okay.
Let's talk about the six different types of...
Let's go to a break first.
But what's the question, though?
Let's go to the six different types of Riesling that are made and how they go from up the order.
Should we go take a break and listen to that?
We can take a break.
Okay, so that's what we're going to come back to, and then we're going to do our last pour.
Perfect.
We'll be right back. Thanks for joining us Inside the Bunghole.
If you want to know more about Inside the Bunghole, join us on all our social media platforms. You can get a revisit and view all the latest posts, giveaways, and information on this podcast. Simply search Inside the Bunghole on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Like, share, and subscribe. Leave a comment. We would love to hear from you. Or you can email us at insidethebunghole@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and visit our website at insidethebunghole.buzzsprout.com, where you can always find our latest podcast and past episodes. Cheers!
Well, welcome back.
Yes.
Katie, thanks again for your time today. This has been absolutely amazing. Can we talk about the six different styles of Riesling?
Yes. So, okay. So there's really no grape or wine that instills fear in sommeliers more than German Rieslings. because of words like Gemüchtersatz and Trockenbärenau Schlesa and Qualitätswein mit Prädikat.
Wow.
And Annebaugebieten and things that just no human being should ever really have to say. And, you know, the thing about them is you really have to say them with that angry German accent, don't you?
Like,
you
can't... I feel like you're cussing me out.
I do. I was feel like that.
If I could just shout in the back of my neck, that would be neat.
right?
Yeah.
I can't, you know, you say, oh, Schlesa. Like, you have to kind of get, like, angry when you say these words.
Spatzlesa.
Spatzlesa, yeah. So, basically, there are ripeness levels, and this was how Germany decided to quantify or qualify its wines, as opposed to in Bordeaux or Burgundy with Grand Cru and Premier Cru and single vineyard, although Germany does do that, which is where it gets super complicated. But in its very basic form, they thought, you know, the different ripeness levels at harvest are going to be a great way to label the wine so people have an idea of what they're getting. So for our last wine, which comes from the Mosel, this is the Nick Wies St. Urban's Hof, one of my absolute favorite producers. You'll notice on the label that it says it's a Cabernet. Cabernet is the earliest picked of all the ripeness levels. So that being said, you can expect that this is going to be one of the drier styles of Riesling. So the Cabernet, it says there. So if we were to go up a ripeness level, it would then say Spätlese. And Spätlese literally translates to mean late picked. And then you know that the sugar level is that much higher. Now, this is important just in kind of that basic winemaking 101, that sugar at the time of harvest and when the grapes start fermenting, all the yeast that gets added, the yeast gobbles up the sugar and that turns it into alcohol, right? So typically in normal winemaking production, the higher the sugar in the grape at fermentation, the higher the alcohol. So with Riesling, the alcohol is usually always really low, and that's because the fermentation doesn't go all the way through, right? All the sugar doesn't get fermented out, so there's that residual sugar left in there. So with a Cabernet, typically the grapes are picked earlier, so there's not that much sugar at the start, and then it does tend to fully ferment out, or at least predominantly ferment out. Then you start getting into the Spätlese, the late picked. You're a little higher up in the sugar level. Then the next level up is an Auslese, even later picked than the Spätlese, so even higher sugar levels, even more concentrated. Because again, the higher the sugar and the later the picked, the more dehydrated the grape gets, which is also why these wines end up getting more expensive, because it takes more grapes to make the same bottle of wine as a Cabernet, right? Hmm. So, and then from Auslese, you have Bärenauslese. And then from Bärenauslese, you have Trockenbärenauslese. I feel like the longer the word gets, the more expensive the wine gets. And then the highest is the Eiswein. And so from there, an Eiswein is a whole separate thing where, you know, there are so many rules. The grapes have to be at a frozen temperature for X amount of time before. And, you know, we can create Eiswein here in California under a manipulated circumstance. But real genuine Eiswein has to go through these natural conditions. And so if it's a warm year or they're not getting the frost or the snow, there's no Eiswein. So which is why that tends to be very expensive. And I think everybody tends to think that these wines are always white. One of the best dessert wines I've ever had was the Inniskillen Eiswein made from Cab Franc. And it's glorious. It is so delicious. Because again, Cab Franc has the spice and a little of the herbaceousness and savoriness to counteract the sweetness. So it's like the notion of chocolate covered pretzels. Who came up with that idea? I don't know. You're a genius.
They
because
are.
It's, you're
Thank
a genius.
You.
Salty, sweet, crunchy.
Yes.
I mean, you're whatever.
Yes. It got me through road trips.
I mean, tell me about
miles.
It. And so I feel like the Cab Franc ice wine is kind of like my chocolate covered pretzel. Oh, like you're just firing on all cylinders at this point.
So this is just 9% alcohol.
Yes.
Wow.
Now
yes.
This hit me as sweet off the bat, because I was
yes,
expecting...
Me too.
I was expecting really...
I'm doing this with Thai foods, spicy, like hot foods. This would be my go-to for this.
Okay, let me wrap my
chops
around this bad boy.
Get in that one.
That is delicious.
Get in on it.
And there's something kind of a...
Oh, man.
You know, it's a...
Okay, so it's apple. It's definitely the apple.
Yes.
It's got that beautiful kind of honey crisp apple right up in front. The secret to Mosel, kind of what we were talking about earlier about soil, the Mosel is all about slate. So that blue slate soil, which is what gives these wines that minerality, which just kind of races up the back, keeps it from being cloying, keeps it from being overly fruity, and lends itself to kind of another layer where, like even on the finish, I'm still tasting kind of that stoniness, right?
Yeah. Is there limestone involved in a lot of where this or no?
Slate. They are known for their slate. And also keep in mind, so we don't have the lake effect that we had going into these two. What we have here is the river, naturally.
The river.
And so what's interesting is the Mosel River kind of carves through the region, and you have the vineyards that are so steep. They're, I mean, like 90-degree angle, practically. I mean, they're just, it's insane. Everything has to be hand-harvested mostly because you just can't even get a machine on something that's going to, you know, cut through a vineyard at that angle. And so what that means is you have the water creating that cooling and warming effect. But because the vineyards now are spaced out on this extreme slope, this sun... So you have this this ripeness that's happening with cool air over a long period of time. So I talk about this a lot with Argentina and Malbec, right? Because in Malbec or in Argentina, in Mendoza, it's all about altitude, right? You've got vineyards at 6,000 feet elevation. Like, what the heck? But when you get above cloud line and fog line and ridge line and all that, there is nothing between the grapes and the sunshine. But the air is so much cooler that the grapes get all that sun, but they're not ripening at that accelerated rate. So it's happening. It's like a soup on a stove that just simmers slowly. And you know, soup's always better the next day or two, right? Because the flavors melt.
Yes.
Grapes, it's the same way. When they're allowed to ripen slowly over time, it just makes those flavors even more intertwined and connected to each other. So when you taste it, it's seamless. Right, it just flows across your palate where everything, there's nothing poking out at you. And as a sommelier, when we look at quality wines, I remember the master who taught me, he asked me one day, you know, we were tasting through wines, and he said, okay, Katie, tell me about this wine. And I kind of went, well, you know, I like it. And am I allowed to swear on this show?
Hell yeah.
Oh, shit, said, yeah.
Fuck yeah.
He looked at me and he said, Katie, I don't give a good goddamn what you think about this wine. He says, I don't give a fuck if you like it or not. Exactly. He said, that's not what I asked you. I asked you to tell me about it.
Right.
And I mean, I almost burst into tears because I was like, okay, I don't know what this means. And he said, you know, your job is not to look at this wine if you would buy it. Your job is to look at this wine if somebody else would buy it. Is this wine a quality wine for the money? Is it seamless? Is it integrated? Does it have a sense of place? You know, there are real determining factors when a sommelier looks at a wine that goes so far beyond what I like or don't like. But it just jarred me so much when he said, I don't give a fuck what you like. Like,
I love it, though. And it's true. It's like...
You should have spoke German.
Don't shop at
him. Put him in his place.
I'm in marketing. It's always... You tell the client, listen, this isn't... You're not advertising to you. You're advertising to the people you want
to shop
their money.
With exactly, exactly.
So I don't care if you watch Golden Girls or if you...
I love
are
Golden
a news
Girls, by the
watcher
way.
Or you watch game shows.
Right.
I want to know who your consumer is watching.
Right.
So that I imagine with wine, a sommelier, you have to take your personality, your own judgment out of it.
Absolutely.
Do some of the American wines lean or try to emulate, I'm sorry to say this, German?
No, I mean, I think if anything, Germany's had a hard time keeping up with the swing of American palates,
right,
wanting bigger, richer, riper, higher octane wines. And that's just not what Germany does. You know, we carry a Pinot Noir from Germany, which is so beautiful, but they're going to be more about the savory notes. They're going to be more about kind of what we call the tertiary notes, right? So the things that if the fruit were to dissipate, what's left? So as a wine ages, the fruit's the first thing that kind of fades away.
Mm-hmm.
But it's those secondary and tertiary notes, like the slate soil and like, you know, the... I don't know, the petrol component and, you know, right, the herbaceousness.
Which is in here too.
Right.
It's in there.
It's
you're
in there.
Right.
Those are the things that have the longevity that carry on. And so, you know, being fruit forward is not what German wines are about. They want that age worthiness.
So this bottle, Nick Weiss, what is this? What does it cost on this?
$23, I think.
Beautiful bottle
it's
of wine.
Not bad,
yeah.
No.
So, and we have Spätlese's and we have single vineyard Auschlese's, and then, you know, we're slowly getting up into the $40, $60, $80 range with these wines. But
and what's a good pairing with this wine?
Again, so for all of these, we're talking about, you know, those spicy, and anything with a lot of aromatics, which is why Thai food always comes in, because lemongrass and mint and coconut milk.
What about
and
Indian food?
Oh, Indian food for sure. All of these ethnic cuisines that have so many aromatics to them, you know, garam masala and curries and, you know, you name it. These wines are such a perfect... you know, addition to the table. And I always like to remind people, look, you know, there's cocktail party wines and there's food wines, and don't get it twisted. Food wines are an extension of what's on your plate. They're meant to make what's on your plate taste better, and what's on your plate is going to make the wine taste better.
Yeah, you right? could sip a wine on the porch and have fun with your rosé.
Yes.
But this is going to be mealtime.
This is mealtime.
More of an experience.
It is.
With that being said, we talked a little bit about this earlier. How would you introduce somebody to a Riesling? Because, as we'd mentioned, the six different, you know, types of Riesling.
Mm-hmm. I'm sold. I'm sold on Riesling.
It's a very complex grape, which a lot of people are afraid to try because of the good old adage about the blue nun.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Of, you know, the blue bottle, the table wine, it's super sweet,
sugary,
what have you. It's
yeah.
too sugary.
Right.
And I think one of the most overwhelming grapes that we have, just because of how well you can make it, depending on what you had mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
How would you sell somebody on a Riesling?
So I always think baby steps is best, right? And so, you know, this is definitely for someone who has, the Nick Weiss is for someone who's wrapped their head around the intricacies of it and, you know, can kind of appreciate the slate and the stoniness and all of those other components. Honestly, I feel like to introduce someone to a Riesling like this is to blow their mind, because this is going to be so unexpected, the two dry styles where they're not, they would be hard pressed to even acknowledge this was a Riesling if they didn't know better before they tasted it. You know, so I think domestic is a great way to go. Dry is a great way to go. But our palates are so cyclical that I laugh sometimes because, you know, I've been doing this for over 20 years now. And everybody starts out, as we joke, drinking Bartles and James or Boone's Farm, or, you know, we want sweet, we want white Zin, right? This is like these are our training wheel wines that we get started on. And then we mature and we get into like big bold cabs and high alcohol. And then we graduate into Pinot Noirs where we think we're very sophisticated and this is very elegant. And then somehow we end up, and I'm now drinking this every night, right? I'm drinking my sweeter Rieslings, my wines that have more depth and, you know, a little of that residual sugar. And then, you know, next thing I know, I'm going to be back around to whatever. And so, you know, our palates are constantly changing. It's like when you're a kid and you won't eat mushrooms or onions or anything red. Yeah. Or anything.
Every 7 years,
right.
They say.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And so wine is no different. The more you drink, the more you expose your palate to things, the more you're going to be open mind to trying new things, and the more drunk you get, and then you're going to be like, you know, I can't believe I drank that. I hate that now. That was my favorite.
I've been wanting to try caviar. I know I had it as a little kid at a party, and I remember, you know,
we'll have a caviar tasting. What would pair with caviar? There you
champagne.
Go. Let's do it.
So invite
me.
We are going to wrap here, but yes. Let's do some shameless plugs.
We're going to do some shameless plugs.
And then I got some shameless plugs here for you, too.
But first, how do we get in touch with Desert 111 Wines?
Yes.
So Desert Wines on 111, we are in Palm Desert. We're on a frontage road. We are the adorable teeny tiny shop that's down from the Red Barn. You can call us at 760-674-0305. And that's 760-674-0305. You can send us an email at info@desertwineshop.com. Or you can go to our website, which is www.desertwineshop.com. You can sign up there for our newsletter. We also have a Facebook page. You can look us up, Desert Wine Shop, on Facebook. We're all over the place. We're all up in your face.
Yeah, and there's no reason someone listening from New Zealand can go to your website and also be on your mailing list.
Absolutely. And New Zealand has Zoom too. So if someone in New Zealand wants to jump on our Zoom Fridays, by all means, you join us.
And we've had listeners from the UK.
Yeah,
we've had some international listeners. Yeah.
Belarus. Katie
Finn.
Yep, that's me.
Thank you so much for an incredible interview.
My pleasure, you guys. Thank you so much for having me on. I love getting nerdy with my fellow wine friends, so thank you so much.
We will have you on again.
Yes, please.
Maybe, Katie, any closing words or thoughts or words of wisdom?
My final thought is what I always tell people: open minds, enjoy more wines, don't be afraid to experiment, and come see us because we're not going to steer you wrong.
Very good.
Very good.
And by the way, Palm Desert is in California, if you have no clue
near Palm Springs, near the Coachella Valley. Yeah.
And I just want to say you can find us on social media at Inside the Bunghole, and that's with Facebook and Twitter and Instagram.
Death.
Mr. Maselli, thank you for introducing us to this wonderful gal.
She's a beautiful lady.
Yes.
Oh,
till then,
let's
keep it. Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
Chin.
With an empty glass. We got to open up the Swiss wine.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thanks for joining us for Inside the Bunghole. Right.
If you want to know more about Inside the Bunghole, join us on all our social media platforms. You can get a revisit and view all the latest posts, giveaways, and information on this podcast. Simply search Inside the Bunghole on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Like, share, and subscribe. Leave a comment. We would love to hear from you. Or you can email us at insidethebunghole@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and visit our website at insidethebunghole.buzzsprout.com, where you can always find our latest podcast and past episodes. Cheers!